Welcome to Moray's podcast series, Speaking of Changing Legal, where we discuss the leading trends and innovations, reshaping the way legal is done. This episode features David Melkinson and Rico Burnett as our hosts for today's topic on AI and legal, the opportunities, challenges, and misconceptions.
Thanks for joining, everybody. I'm David Melkinson. This is Rico Burnett. We're from a firm called Moray. We are specialists in sort of technology for lawyers and the legal process. So, you know, as you can imagine, AI within the context of legal is a pretty hot topic, mainly because people think it's quite ripe for disruption. You know, most people's view of the legal team, the legal process, is it can be a bit opaque, unnecessarily complicated, and just slows things down. And because it's underpinned by the written word, you're thinking, okay, this is pretty ripe for disruption by AI. And it is. Things are happening and at pace, but nowhere near as fast as people would expect. So what we're going to do today is we're going to dive into some of the reasons why, tell you where things are today, and sort of give you a roadmap for the future in terms of AI within the legal process. But, you know, let's deal with some fundamentals first of all. You know, lots of firms, everybody in this room, you've got some AI infrastructure in place, you've got workflows, you've got some agents running. But many firms fail to address the real fundamentals of legal. And that is actually, where is this document here? Underpins this entire process is underpinned by one PDF, which is buried in somebody's OneDrive. And this is a lot more common than you would think in terms of where things are. And this is basics, but these are real stats. You know, a lot of companies don't even know where the contracts are. If they know where their contracts are, they're split across an average of 24 different systems because these contracts are sort of owned by everyone and no one. You know, it will pass through the legal team and then it'll be sent back via email and it'll just be. So, and what that means is things are missed. You miss renewals. You don't increase prices when you could do. You're missing out on termination clauses. And these things are just not being managed properly. And it's incredible. It's this hidden cost, which is actually incredibly expensive.
So as a reforming lawyer myself, who's now lucky to be in this industry, there's a key cost to poor management of contracts, especially with the rise of AI and the opportunities we are missing. So some unfortunate statistics for you. The average number of active contracts a company in the Fortune 500 has is at least 30,000. It costs around 9,000 euros to take an average low-risk agreement from authoring through to signature. The average time for an NDA, which is pretty much fundamental to every commercial contracting relationship, is around 7 days at the moment. That is an improvement from past decades. It's still stuck at a week. Current survey results tell us that 18% of your sales cycle will be consumed by contracting. Not client relationship, not client success, not commercials, but actual process of getting a piece of paper in place. And staggeringly, surveying some of the Fortune 200, companies with more than 1,000 employees spent an average of 2.3 million euros on finding their contracts during this journey to get them into a form or a location or a place where actual contract management can exist. So it's at a high cost.
And, you know, with such a glaring problem like that, you would have thought, okay, fine, get hold of the documents, it'll integrate with those 24 systems, we'll apply some RAG to it, we'll turn it into some structured data, and hey, presto. Yes, but not quite. You know, it's not quite that straightforward, and it's part technology, and it's mostly human. You know, lawyers are very slow to adopt new technology. What we actually ask them to do is manage risk for us. So they're constantly thinking about risk. That's how they think. That's how they've been taught their entire career to think about risk. You know, we rely on them being very accurate, extremely precise and consistent and not missing a single thing. So you can't think of anything more off-putting to a lawyer when you give who accuracy and predictability is the number one thing. You give them a machine that makes things up and gives you a different result every single time. It's a complete anathema to them. You know, and hallucinations particularly are a lawyer's worst nightmare. This is a famous case of it happened at the early days of ChatGPT, where a litigation lawyer filed a motion with some fake case law in it, made up by ChatGPT. Now, that's not only hugely embarrassing for the person, for the individual. Legal is a regulated industry, so they can get struck off straight away. And even worse, what will happen is if these things slip through the net, and some might have done, is that actually then goes into case law, permanent case law, which is then polluted forever. So it's a real, real problem.
So we would expect that, as with all industries and complicated industries, leveraging, you know, generative AI in the space of legal contracting should be possible and should be pursued, and it should. But sadly, it's not that straightforward. And, you know, as I said, as somebody who was in the industry, I do apologize on behalf of an entire industry, but, you know, why is leveraging Gen AI in contracting not straightforward? Well, because we have distinct legal terminology that has existed for, one would have to say, hundreds of years and hasn't really changed that much. And if you can't really see the little jab at distinct terminology, the two kids are trick-or-treating, you know, honey, some young trespassers want us to compensate them in candy in consideration for the promise to refrain from performing intentional torts on our property. They're going to TP the house if you don't give them any sweets. Legal terminology, by its very nature, is distinct from other disciplines. We have the challenge, as David mentioned, of jurisdictional variability. Common law jurisdictions, civil law jurisdictions, how they deal with language. And then we have hybrid jurisdictions. We have case law. We have precedent. And we have this influx of different views of how language is even used in the process of jurisprudence that makes it a difficult task. But finally, we unfortunately have the notion of deliberate ambiguity where, in a negotiation, if I can secure the preferred position for my client as opposed to your client, I believe I've won. So it's a slightly different approach to looking at how contracting works. Now, to answer a very simple question, one which is ideally suited for the world we are living in. Quick one. How much will my contract be worth in 5 years' time? Right, so we have a clause over there. You can, of course, read it for yourself, but the pricing contained in the proposal for services shall remain fixed during the first 2 years of the contract. The hourly rate may be adjusted once annually in accordance with the methodology outlined below. Fairly straightforward stuff. So if you're looking at training a model, okay, what we want to achieve is we can have a price adjustment once a year. Sadly, that's where the fun begins, because the rest of the clause says the contractor may be granted increases of the hours dependent upon the fluctuations in CPIU as published. An annual increase in that rate shall be lesser of 2% or a cap over the 12 months preceding on or about the 90 days before the anniversary of the contract. Now, I've studied law for about 16 years. It's hard for me to read this, much less for any of you to have to stomach it. So how exactly will we do that? I mean, who's going to log in 90 days before, check the Department of Labor's Bureau for Labor Statistics, determine that that is a prevailing rate? Even if we do all of that, it says it may be granted, not shall or will. So there's no guarantee contained in any of that. Gets worse, unfortunately, for all of you looking at this slide. The contractor must request such adjustments. And the base month for all of this is the third month prior to the start date of the contract. It's going to be based on that CPI and will become effective. But you've just said to me, we may choose to do it. Now, it will be effective. So what's your poison here? We may do it. We will do it. Thinking about doing it. And all of a sudden, you're telling me this is the required time frame. But you've just labored on about 90 days and 3 months. What's happening in this clause? And then finally, couldn't you just have used the phrase 90 days like you did in the preceding paragraph? We get to the third month prior to the start date of the contract. Now, if this is a PDF buried in the machinery David has explained in the opening slide, trying to point a model and to augment learning based on this type of clause does not bode well for any kind of consistency or quality. And then finally, since we just want to hammer the point, and you know, we do like to charge in 6-minute increments as attorneys, as long as all of this is submitted within the required time frame, blah, 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 once approved or rejected. So what's the point of all of this mechanical process of establishing CPI, logging in 90 days before to check the Department of Labor's rates, if at the end of the day, there's a simple arbitrary clause that says we can reject all of that if we wanted to? So to train a model on pricing, establish for me the pricing principles and the practices in this contract is nearly impossible. Even an AI engine will say, well, yeah, really, what's the point of all of this? So the point of that quick introduction to how interpretation of the clause will work is generative AI fundamentally can assist in drafting a much better clause. So this is just an example of asking GPT to rephrase the clause. A lot simpler, a lot more compliant with plain language requirements as well. But even the redrafted clause doesn't answer the specific question of what exactly is my contract going to be worth in 5 years. So I can make no decision making in terms of financial performance, of validity, of enforceability, of negotiation, because the base of the negotiation and the legal process fundamentally doesn't lend itself, unfortunately, to what we'd like to achieve in the era of Gen AI. This one we'll skip over because hopefully none of you work for these companies, but a case about 8 years ago, the position of that comma effectively cost Bell $1 million per year in licensing. I'll skip over some of that, but
we got time.
Great. Okay, so we'll just keep you there. Bell argued that that clause says, the positioning of that comma says, whatever goes precedes the comma, I can ignore, because if I give you a year's notice, I can terminate the contract. So great, that's fine. The comma is there. It's clear. It's unambiguous. It's fine. But then Rogers Communication played the magical Uno reverse card, feared and revered all over the world. And they said, yes, but we also have a French version of the contract. There is no comma in the French version. You imperialists, we must look at the French version. And on that interpretation, the comma is not supposed to be there because the English lawyers did not pay any attention to the French lawyers. And if you consider we've got roughly 50 to 60 countries in the world that require contracts to be drafted, also in non-English, you can see how the location of a comma, which is, you know, punctuation we tend to ignore, can make a significant difference. In this case, because Rogers won, Bell could not terminate the agreement before the first five-year period was over, and Rogers saved $1 million per annum in fees. So the positioning of something as simple as a punctuation mark is important in the law, and it's a challenge when you look at the accuracy and precision with which AI works and is able to function. And we're not at that level of accuracy or precision by any means. So it's important to use the words that you know and not to use words that you don't know. You would expect that to change, but it hasn't.
But, you know, legal is catching up slowly, and it's catching up at pace, sort of almost exponentially. And there's some things that have allowed that to happen. Firstly, the technology is improving, particularly with larger context windows. I heard a lawyer the other day, and she said, I'm barely getting going with a contract at page 40. So, you know, page 40, 50, 100 page, big documents, quite often scanned in fairly dodgily. So actually that's made a big difference. One of the biggest problems was data privacy, and there's a much more pragmatic view on data privacy from the lawyers. They look after some of the most secretive, most important documents going, really. You know, they're right in the middle of big M&A transactions. They hold these documents within their own system. So security is a huge deal to them, and obviously putting them out to an open AI public endpoint is not something that they have been willing to do. But there is downward pressure on the legal industry to become more efficient for obvious reasons, because they need to be very slow and expensive. And that's making a big difference as well. But really, what are we trying to do? There's really three things in a corporate context, which is what this technology can do, is better understand the obligations that you have within the contract to try and bring that 9.2% down. Speed up contract cycle times just to try and keep things more efficiently, and just don't gum up deals in the legal process. And third is to reduce cost of the overall thing. There has been, and increasingly so, this downward cost pressure on legal departments and also on law firms, whilst at the same time legal complexity increases the entire time as the world gets more complex and regulated. So there's some tech which is helping now, and there's a big difference between simple or more straightforward legal work like NDAs that Rico mentioned, lower complexity things. Whereas this is low-hanging fruit for automation. One of the very useful things is actually automatic markups of language within Word, which is where lawyers still live 99% of the time. So there are playbooks which could be created where your positions on things like limitation of liability, things like assignments, could be automatically put in a playbook. The machine can read the playbook, understand the contract, and give you a markup automatically. That's going to get you about 80% of the way there, sometimes 50%, depending on the complexity, but it certainly helps the initial understanding of the document that's coming through to save you reading it from top to bottom, but also flagging those provisions as well. So you can see here there are automatic clauses that are commented up and ready to be reviewed by a human. And you can also automate risk scores within those documents as they're being reviewed. And this tech is improving all of the time. And there's various different suppliers that will do that. You can build your own, or this is Contract Podlier that we use. The second is findability. So actually finding contracts, what you can't really do. The average law firm of, let's say, 1,000 people within it, they've got about 80 to 100 million records that they need to keep hold of, and it's not practical on any level to just put that vectorize that entire data set currently. So findability and actually just going through and classifying these documents, quite often using old school machine learning, is very, 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 very useful. So you'll see here, automatic classification means they can find prior work. So they can do in a contract, they can find a decent recent example done by somebody else, then do some keyword searching and find that document, then use that document to jump off. So that is pretty big. Previously, they've relied on manual tagging, which is useless most of the time. So that's quite a big deal. And extracting data points, so turning these unstructured data within that are buried within documents with the complicated language that Rico was talking about, turning that into a structured data set is not only useful, so you can see what your contractual landscape is. You can see what your previously negotiated positions are, so you can automatically know what you've agreed and haven't agreed to previously. Is a really big deal. What you've got to make sure when you do this, though, is there isn't any technology so far that can be done without a human in the loop. There's too many complexities. The machines are just not there. It can get you about 80% of the way there. So making sure you have things like this with the... I don't know if this flicker work? Probably not. Oh, yeah, here you go. Things like this. So somebody's going to eyeball what's been extracted on the left-hand side, and then it'll automatically highlight the point in the document as well. So you can do a human review of these extracted clauses, adjust them if necessary. And then you've got what everybody's after, which is a structured data source, so you can manage contracts properly. Then once you've got the structured data source, you can actually do things with it using either AI or other workflow tech to manage things like renewal dates, which are missed all of the time. Things like conditions that you can then view at the customer entity level.
So one of the key challenges is getting the legal industry, who work mostly with words, into the environment that we've been discussing for the last day and in the workshops yesterday, is around, you know, visualization and about graphs and about representing data in relation to each other. Really hard to do if you're working in text. So if you would, and this is just really basic examples, I don't know if anybody is still here from Microsoft, but you know, Power BI skin over a workflow. Now, considering the first point made, which is on average companies are losing about 9% of revenue due to poor contract management. If you could go to the board and tell them, I could increase revenue by up to 9% if embedded a bit of technology underpinned by the right AI. I mean, it does become a very, very compelling use case. This is one example where simple workflow monitoring, the type of documents and the status and positioning of those documents at any point in this process is monitored and active. So as an instruction or a query comes in, an agent, a type of agent, will view the data set, create a visual, and you are effectively reducing the dependency on the wrong type of human in the loop. We talked about humans being necessary for the sophisticated work, but if I can understand workflow volumes, I can understand my legal throughput, and I can manage risk much more effectively. And when we talk about litigation budgets, which are skyrocketing, you'll see some of the litigation, even just on AI and dataset use, those costs are not coming down. and to give yourself some certainty, because you're pretty much visualizing something which actually already should exist in your organization, it makes a really big difference.
And managing cost is a huge thing. As I mentioned before, there's constant downward cost pressure. So one of the, when the chief legal officer will then go and sit at the board and ask for more money or more headcount, you need statistics in order to be able to back that up. So a lot of tech these days is looking at ways of being managing workload, justifying workload, so you can therefore justify the headcount. And AI is making a big difference to that. And the other thing is these complex, more complex cases that then go to outside counsel, to a law firm, is where most of the spend goes. And AI is having a big impact in assessing these invoices that come in, usually on a time crunch in an M&A deal or in a litigation case. These great big invoices come up with like thousands of line items of individual 6-minute chunk narratives. So how can you work out whether you're being overcharged by a law firm? It's very, very difficult. There are banks of humans that you can put to the task to eyeball these things, or you can apply AI. So this is some AI that we developed to actually look at invoices that they come in. Then you can marry, you can look at the document management system, be it SharePoint, be it iManage, be it pick your poison, tie up that invoice to the actual legal product and vet that for quality. And also things like, the biggest thing is this, overqualified personnel. So it's a simple review task should be done by an associate at a lower billing rate. What happens when the associates are busy? The partner comes in, whacks on the partner's senior rate for a task which shouldn't need a partner. So why should firms be paying the full on top rate for simple work? That's the number one thing that it's actually quite tricky to catch that. But semantic understanding of these narratives that you get with each individual 6-minute chunks is becoming really, really impactful for that as well. Other things like excessive hours. So commonly you'll have two associates to one meeting. Well, you don't need two associates, but you'll spot one will be on page 6 and the other one will be on page 27, and trying to marry those two things up difficult. So there is a block billing where you're just, all sorts of things can happen within it, but we've done this now across 5 separate firms. It's fairly new, and 15% sort of savings is significant. So I think we're nearly on time, Rico.
I mean, this is staggering. This is, I don't know.
Time for our thousands of we questions could do, we're going to get.
We could do Sergey's presentation as well, I think, at this pace. So contextualizing why the legal department is a stakeholder in the generative AI landscape, I think is also important, and why you should spare a thought for the legal departments and their challenges, because predominantly the perception on the legal services industry is it's a slow adopter and it presents a significant break to development. Franz Kafka said, I think he said, a lawyer is the only person that is allowed to write a 10,000 page document and call it a brief. So, you know, we do have a reality, and the 5 key points to take away is, as you've heard, you know, if you attended Jalal's session earlier today, there's a vastly changing AI landscape. You know, the penalties, the accountability, all of that fundamentally sits within the broad legal function within most organizations. Now, that presents a major sleepless night scenario for most lawyers who are confronted with this. They must be both the gatekeepers and the enablers of this technology. Secondly, the vast acceleration in the development of intellectual property, which needs to be carefully managed both internally, and then the data privacy challenges with what the common man is now using GenAI for at work, which is not well enough protected and which presents a challenge. Even just the educational piece, we looked at the workshop yesterday, educating the business on the risks and dangers is not easy. Providing the training, raising awareness around the use and the risks of Gen AI, not just AI. Most businesses don't believe they've ever used AI, much less that's been a fact of commercial life for a long time. Fourthly, vendor management. The obligation to now start managing your vendors and their use of generative AI is becoming a really hot topic for discussion. At events we're at, there's a lot of discussion. How do I ensure the compliance of my vendors with both ethical generative AI use, safe deployment, and data sovereignty? That's becoming a major challenge that is a key part of how the legal industry is looking at generative AI. But vendor management, key topic for the future. Then finally, the unfortunate reality, along with cyber breaches, which as you know, the data cyber breaches are hitting, you know, one in three companies at this point, is incident management and litigation support. So the challenge from a legal department point of view to come to grips with the discussions that we've had over the last 2 days on how this technology will work is complicated in the face of an industry that predominantly wants two people to sit across a table and exchange pieces of paper. However, in this reality, we can see, of course, as we've been discussing today, that generative AI functionally will allow us to change the way that legal services are delivered and the way that legal provide insight and input into how technology is going to evolve.
Good. So thank you for listening. Quick pitch slap for what we do. We've about 1,200 strong in terms of an organization. We have offices in Germany, in the UK, US and Australia. We can see what we do there. Mainly we've got technology as a big part of what we do, mixed with humans and lawyers in order to make sure that we can cope with the end-to-end legal process. So do come and see us. We've got a stand just out there. Do come and say hello. It'd be great to come to catch up. So thank you very much.